This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Shane Ferreter was interested in space from the time he was a young boy growing up in central Nebraska. He worked on NASA projects throughout college and graduate school at MIT, and even spent a year at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Now a professor at University of Nebraska, Shane still works on the Mars rover and other space projects. But the company he co-founded in 2006 has more to do with improving medicine than sending a rocket to Mars. Lincoln-based Virtual Incision is developing a first-of-its-kind miniaturized surgical robot that goes into the body. The company has 50 employees and has raised more than $100 million of funding. Shane, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. You were working on robots and space technologies when your co-founder, Dmitry Oleynikov, then a surgeon and professor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, showed up at your door. How did the two of you land on the idea for Virtual Incision?
Well, there's a little bit of a backstory. The University of Nebraska Medical Center, which is our state's place where they educate doctors, of course, was a very early adopter of robotic surgery. There's a system on the market called the Da Vinci system, and they bought the eighth one ever sold, I believe. Work with a donor, they were able to kind of do this state-of-the-art surgery. And Dmitry was recruited to start that program. But he did robotic surgery and I built robots. We very quickly got together and we just kind of saw and hoped for a different way. We always say we make small robots that go inside of the body instead of big robots that are on the outside reaching in.
It's like science fiction. Virtual Incision is likely to be the first company to bring to market surgical robots that go into the body. Explain how a surgeon would use your Mira platform, say, to take out a patient's colon.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I should start out by saying we're not an FDA-approved medical device at this time, but we're working towards the ability to do procedures like colon resection. And the procedure itself is very similar to how it's always or has been done for many years, either robotically or even with manual laparoscopic surgery. So an incision is made, the patient's inflated, actually, the abdominal wall is kind of lifted up from the organs using laparoscopic techniques. The device is inserted into the body, and then it's got a couple arms, a right hand and a left hand, and a camera like your head that looks left and right. It's really like we've taken the surgeon and shrunk them down and put them inside the body. And you use grasping and cutting and cautery, and you can perform surgeries that way.
How much does this dwarf surgeon weigh?
The device itself is quite light. It weighs just a couple pounds, a little bit less than 2 pounds. So most of the surgical robots out there are very large, 8 or 9 feet tall and weigh 2,000 pounds. Ours is much, much smaller, you know, 20 inches long and weighs 2 pounds.
So if the surgeon is taking out part of my colon, it's 2 pounds going into an incision they make that puts the 2 pound robot goes into my body.
Yeah, it extends in, it kind of straightens out so that it can go in through the smallest possible incision and then unfolds inside the body. And then again, it's like we've shrunk the surgeon down and put them inside.
You and Dmitry started Virtual Incision in 2006. What made it take so long to commercialize the company's technology, you know, to bring it to market?
Well, I think if you look at we'll start with medical devices. Medical devices is a different animal than a lot of startup companies. It's not a web app or something that you can just make and hand it to customers and let them try it out. It takes a long time to get the device working very well, do a lot of testing on it, and then there's this FDA process you have to jump through. So inherently, medical devices, I think, are a long process for startups. I think that's even more true with surgical robotics. You know, we have a robot, we have a camera, we have electrosurgical generator, we have control console. All these components could be startup companies in and of themselves. It's really kind of a platform that's required to do all these things together. So there's a lot of work that has to be done before you can commercialize.
There are a lot of companies trying to make surgical robots, but Virtual Incision has been more efficient, you know, use less capital to achieve more progress than the others by a factor of about 10. Why is that?
Yeah, maybe not quite a factor of 10, but we have been incredibly capital efficient. Part of that's because it's been, you know, capital's been hard to raise. So especially in our earlier days, we have a wacky idea. Maybe wacky is not the right word, but we're trying to do things differently. So that makes that challenging. But, you know, I'm on a Midwest podcast, and I think that factors in here too. I think we don't waste a lot of money, and we don't, cash is king, obviously. And I think we have been very, very capital efficient.
You grew up in central Nebraska. Your parents owned a hardware store. You learned a lot from that too, right?
I did from that place and those people. Certainly I learned a great deal. When you're out there and you're, harvesting and something breaks, you got to kind of figure it out and fix it yourself. So you go to the hardware store and you don't have exactly the perfect parts, but you figure out what you got to do to get your corn in. And that process and that way of thinking has stuck with me for a long time.
That's interesting. I was thinking as you were saying that, not innovation, but ingenuity.
Yes, definitely. Both are important.
In 2022, you and University of Nebraska received funding from NASA to ready the surgical robot, the Mira platform, for a 2024 test mission aboard the International Space Station, tying your startup to your long-running interest in space. Your Mira platform will simulate surgery. How's that going to work? What's it going to do up there?
Yeah, I guess I'll back up a little bit too. So my other job is I'm faculty at the University of Nebraska. I'm a professor in mechanical engineering. And Dimitri and I had done research for many, many years before the company and then sort of in parallel with the company. And both the Army and NASA had funded us. Both want to do surgery in crazy places, right? They want to do surgery in far, not hospital settings. The Army wants to do it in forward environments where people are shooting at you. And NASA, of course, wants to go deeper and further into space, and surgery might enter into the equation at some point there. So our little robots lend themselves to being very transportable and deployable. So we've been working on this for a long time. And just kind of as a natural progression of that process, we've moved the technology forward far enough that we received the award you mentioned to fly our robot on the International Space Station. So right now we're putting that experiment together to send it to the International Space Station, do some very basic simulated surgical tasks kind of as a first step in that direction. I'm really excited about it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Is there a difference between the way a robot would perform on Earth and in space?
Well, the lack of gravity is a big factor. It's the first and most obvious one. So there'll be some new challenges associated with that, but it's really, we want to demonstrate our technology and show what's possible.
So when you say simulated, is there something it's going to go into, a pillow or?
Yeah. So the space station has these set of lockers, basically kind of these microwave sized lockers, which are kind of a holdover from the mid deck of the space shuttle. And we're going to go into one of those lockers and we'll have some rubbery soft tissue models that we'll try to do dissection on. And again, the lack of gravity there will sort of change the way we handle things, and we'll see how it goes. We're working with NASA now. Hopefully we're going to be able to teleoperate our devices from someplace like Johnson Space Center and be able to control devices on the space station. So we'll see. We'll see where we end up.
It looks like Virtual Incision has a good shot at being first to market with these surgical robots. Taking a riff on that trajectory, what does surgery look like 50 years from now?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, there are other robotic surgery devices out there. We're the first sort of small in vivo intercorporeal triangulation device that is the fancy term we use.
That was fancy.
Well, I go back to put my professor hat on, I guess. So we, if you look out 50 years, you know, I always imagine that there's the red pill and the blue pill, that when you go to bed, you take both pills. One sedates you and the other one is a robot that will go inside of you and do some work and then pass out the other end. That's kind of the wacky, crazy thought about how surgery might work. I'm not sure that's even a 50-year vision, but What I'm certain of is our inability to predict what it will look like. I don't think it'll be big, expensive machines that are scarce. I think it'll be more common. I think robots will play a role in almost every surgery of all kinds of different types. So I think there's a lot of room for robotics and robotic technology to improve the practice of surgery. And we're happy to be part of that.
Throughout your education, which culminated with a PhD in mechanical engineering from MIT, you worked on all these space-related projects. You studied at the Kennedy Space Center and Goddard Space Flight Center. So you've got a great understanding of this. Where are we in terms of exploration of space, and what kinds of technologies and activities are on the horizon?
Well, it's going to be an exciting time, right? Obviously, the front and center is the Artemis program in NASA that's returning to the moon, and that's going to be very, very exciting. And then SpaceX has talked about, you know, since their inception, talked about going to Mars. Both are big. I was just having a similar conversation with my wife, actually. I don't know if you remember the movie The Martian with Matt Damon in it, right? And a big part of that movie was that they needed to resupply him, and NASA had one rocket to do that with, and it blew up, and so they had to go to the Chinese, and the Chinese helped, and there were two rockets on Earth that could help with this, right? It doesn't at all look like it's going to be like that. We're talking about many, many different types of rockets, and SpaceX talks about building 1,000 rockets, not worrying about just having two, but two on Earth, have 1,000 with one company, you know? So it's going to change a lot, and it's really, really exciting. You know, the Falcon 9's launching once a week now. It's crazy stuff.
Sounds like the Full Employment Act for your research lab.
There's going to be a lot of work to do, yes.
Also want to ask you, you know, you've been now through this startup thing for a long time. What kind of tips do you have for other entrepreneurs, particularly those doing really hard, deep tech kind of companies?
Well, I would be very encouraging, honestly. Usually when I talk to people about this, you know, you're the expert in this area, and you're the one that has to make this happen. You're going to need a lot of people around you to help you, but I really encourage them to push forward. My entrepreneurial journey has been incredibly rewarding. I really enjoyed the process. You know, I think it's improved my research at the university. I think it's made me smarter. I think I've learned many, many things, and that's all wonderful. But hopefully what you're doing is going to help people, right? So we're excited about making surgery more available in more operating rooms. And that's a worthwhile goal. It's a good reason to get up in the morning. And, you know, that should be at the core of what you want to do is helping people.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll be back with more Midwest Moxie. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Josh Reedy's grandfather was taken to the hospital with burns after the generator that provided electricity to his family's South Dakota ranch exploded. Once healed, he responded to the tragedy by starting an electricity co-op. Years later, acting on a similar impulse, Josh started Thread, a Grand Forks company whose software helps utilities and other companies use data from unmanned aerial systems and robotics to manage their infrastructure. Thread has raised a total of about $17 million and has around 50 full-time employees. Josh, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you, Kathleen, for having me.
Let's talk about your grandfather's response to that generator accident. It left a lasting impression on you. Tell us about it.
It did. As the man that I grew up with, second only to my father, he had a passion for that cooperative. And it took a while for me to understand why. But in light of the tragedy, you could see the motivation, and that motivation translated into accomplishment. He not only started the cooperative, he was the first and only board chairman for nearly 40 years.
Wow, what an accomplishment. Out of tragedy comes something good.
Absolutely.
You earned a Doctor of Education degree and taught for a bit, then became the second youngest dean at the University of North Dakota. But the important thing is you discovered an aptitude for technology.
Absolutely. Not only an aptitude for technology, but how it was applied in an academic setting, research in particular. It fascinated me. And that coupled with the emerging UAS industry, of which the University of North Dakota was the first to offer a baccalaureate program all the way back in 2008, it was a perfect combination to incubate the skills that I now need as a CEO of a technology startup in the Midwest.
Let's back up a little. The emerging what industry?
Unmanned aircraft systems or uncrewed aircraft systems, UAS.
You quit your university job to be on the leadership team of a local startup. And let's just say startups are few and far between in the Dakotas, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. Then you quit your job at the startup to found Airtonomy, which is now Thread. Is it harder to quit a good job and found a startup in the Dakotas?
You know, that's a great question. And to answer it directly, absolutely. Life is good in the Midwest, and the mentality or the culture that you're born into is creating that very holistic life of which I think a certain degree of complacency can set in. And it is not typical, as you indicated, to not only found a technology startup, but to quit your job and do so and put everything that I had to my name on the line to create that company. I think of it as a progression. I left a academic career, and I actually moved to the west side of campus and worked with intellectual property that I was a part of generating. And that allowed me to work with a company, not as a founder, but as a early employee. And I learned an awful lot at that company. And yet I had a vision of how to apply a technology that has yet to been or hadn't yet been created. And so that point in my life, that confluence of many different factors was literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but I took it, and it's led to where we're at today.
So the technology led you to that once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and your background, you thought you could do it. If it hadn't worked, it's hard to get another job, though, right?
Exactly. I don't think many people realize that in communities the size of Grand Forks, there's often one job of one job. And if you are in a career field, you would have to leave. And so for me, it was a bit of do or die in the area that if this startup wasn't successful, I would have to find employment elsewhere. And it's hard to remember a world before COVID, but this was before, remote work was really accepted. So it was a high stakes game for me personally and professionally.
A few weeks after you started what's now called Thread, you got a call to go to Fargo to meet Brad Smith, the president of Microsoft. What a break.
Right. You know, it's almost hard to believe when you say it now. A wonderful program that Microsoft created in their philanthropical organization, TechSpark, had a chapter in or a office in Fargo. And TechSpark, in my words, is meant to spark technology innovation away from the coast. And so I had engaged with Teo Spellhog, who is the representative in North Dakota, and I had persistently done so. And Teo to this day will laugh and say she humored me, but she saw something in the concept. And lo and behold, Brad Smith came to town for a TED Talk. And when I was given the opportunity to meet with Brad and others from Microsoft, it was a life-changing moment, one that I am forever grateful for and one that I will never forget.
They invested in your startup.
TechSpark did. They put out a competitive program that we won as a company, and dollars from TechSpark, they were the first money in. That was matched by our amazing partners at the University of North Dakota's Aerospace Foundation. And then the community of Grand Forks, in the form of the Economic Development Corporation in the city of Grand Forks, rounded out our seed funding, if you will, above and beyond what I had personally put in, to the tune of about $400,000.
The new Midwestern way.
Absolutely. It is surreal. And I can say today, and I say proudly, it was not of my doing. But you can see a pathway that is similar to ours that is now embedded within our state and our community. North Dakota has fabulous support structures and funding for early stage startups, most of which is non-dilutive. And it's fun to say I was associated with that. Our company was associated with it, but absolutely amazing to see the work of Governor Burgum and others to make that possible for other entrepreneurs.
After growing up on a farm that once didn't have electricity from utility, you're running a company that helps utilities modernize. What are the faults in America's utility, your energy infrastructure, and what are you addressing?
You know, I'm so thankful you asked that question, because I close my eyes and I think about where we're at today, and I can see a mixture of the past and the present. One event that I did not speak of, but was influential, is that the electrical cooperative my grandfather founded and was his passion. There was a one of those early winter or late fall ice storms and snowstorms that snapped literally almost every pole within that cooperative, laid the poles flat and caused people to be without power for not days, but weeks, and I think in some cases months. That was the final, I think, straw for me in understanding that we have what we call critical infrastructure that our nation relies upon, be it the energy you rely on, or the fuel, or your water, or your wireless communication. That truly powers innovation in our lifestyle in 2022. And yet the tools used to inspect and manage that critical infrastructure is really from a bygone era, the same era that my grandfather founded that electrical cooperative. And what I mean by that is we rely on brave men and women to maintain that infrastructure. But THRED is to critical infrastructure such as utility poles and wind turbines and coal plants and solar farms, as to Epic in what it was to electronic medical records and healthcare. We are, in essence, digitizing that infrastructure based upon the knowledge that is in the heads of those frontline workers, so that decisions can be made in a more timely fashion and better, especially when time is a matter of difference between life and death, such as in blizzards or hurricanes or major outages.
So you say the first step for utility to modernize, or other companies, is to digitize its assets. But what does that mean? How do you digitize a pole or a wire?
Absolutely. So it is a unique combination of sensor data. And when I say sensor data, that could be imagery that could come from your cell phone or a drone. It could be infrared imagery, it could be LIDAR data, or even sonic data. The sensor type doesn't matter. But think of it this way, that if you think of, again, a parallel to electronic medical records, the X-ray of your lungs to know if you have an infection is taken very purposefully. We use drones and we allow frontline workers to capture the relevant data with purpose, meaning the drone positions itself autonomously to take the images of the components that matter most, and does so in a highly precise manner, so that a machine in machine learning or AI knows the difference and knows that there's continuity. It means that you can sort away all of the human error that our brains, our minds, our eyes cannot see when we capture imagery manually. And we do that because, in essence, if you think of peering through the eyes of a frontline worker to understand the condition of a power line or a wind turbine or a coal plant, that's relevant, as well as the decision-making, the training that they've had to understand if something they're seeing is indeed broken or in a state of need for repair. So instead of people's, frontline workers' eyes and minds, we're using robotics and sensors, and we're using artificial intelligence so that there is a non-biased way of automating the assessment of the condition of those assets, knowing if something's functional or in need of maintenance or in need of replacement or repair. And we aggregate that together so that if you are a decision maker at a utility or an energy company, you now have that information at your fingertips, especially at times that you need it most, which are outages.
One more thing. Being in North Dakota, I'm sure you see the difference, the palpable difference between a small business and a startup. We've got a lot of small businesses in the Midwest. What makes a small business a startup?
Wonderful question, and one that I think is the answer to is misunderstood in the Midwest, and is the difference between the Midwest and let's say coastal communities like Silicon Valley. And that is, I would say most, myself included, are taught to be financially or fiscally conservative, to be mindful of how you spend your money, to always think of the future, to save and to take small bites and to, you know, block and tackle moving forward in life. Yet a startup is different than that. And most people don't understand that you may start as a small business when you're a startup, but the reality is there is an inflection point that you have to decide to take a chance. And you partner with those that are willing to take chances with you, which that could be a partner, a customer, an investor, in our case, all of the above. But at that point, as a startup founder, you decide to go big or go home. And you pour fuel on the flame, you accelerate your growth, and you try to make a large entry into an ecosystem. And in our case, with Peer Innovation, we chose that startup path because we saw a huge opportunity that required venture capital to grow the type of team that we need to accomplish what we want to do and to build the product that we envision. But the reality is that is counterintuitive to our culture. You asked me a question about quitting my day job. Quitting your day job to focus intensely on the success of a startup is not for the faint of heart, because it's not necessarily all of the fun things that you hear founders start or talk about when they exit. It's all of the hard work that happens from the starting point and the inception to whatever type of exit you may have, whether that be successful or unsuccessful. That determination, that risk-taking, that willingness to go against the grain is what it takes to be a successful startup and a successful startup founder. And I hope that others are able to acknowledge that, understand what they're getting themselves into, and if they're still there, if their heart's into it, go for it.
The algorithm of risk. Thank you, Josh Reedy, for sharing with us your startup journey and the calibrating for us the risks you took, and good luck with Thread.
Kathleen, it's been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.